Everybody, welcome to another episode of Restaurant Success Club. Super excited today. This is season two, episode one. We had a wonderful season last year with some really great people. Two of those people have joined me today. Jay Ashton, Canada's restaurant guy, is here from Canada. He is my co-host today. And Michael Tips from Maverick Theory. He's an actor, he's a consultant, he's a restaurant owner, you name it, he's got it. We will have him on another show at some point because he was on the show Bar Rescue, and we're going to do a whole show on that in the future. But today, we're going to be talking about the newsletter that I wrote about cultivating culture, and the two guests today, I think my co-host Jay and my guest Michael Tips are going to be fantastic additions to that. So if you're joining us live, please feel free to comment or ask questions, and I'll pop those up on the feed as we go. This is being recorded for podcast as well. Super excited. Jay Ashton is the producer of my Restaurant Success podcast, and super excited to be doing that. But here we go. So Jay, little bit about you to the audience, and then we'll hit Michael, and then we'll get on with the show.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, I have nothing to these celebrities. It's crazy. You know what? I've been in the industry quite some time, just celebrating my 34th year, and been really deep into. Oh, there's Jason.
Jason Brooks is on. If you don't know Jason, he just wrote a book called Every Leader Needs Followers.
Yeah, and he sent me one. I don't have it yet, but awesome guy. Awesome. Love his book. Anyways, I've been in the industry 34 years. I've consulted with thousands of restaurants in Canada or across Canada. I also built the business resource part for the largest food company in Canada and in the United States. I did that for 12 years. And right now I produce, was it 7 or 8 podcasts, this one including. And also I really am working on new coaching and programs right now for large hotels and restaurants and all that good stuff.
There. You want to talk about the big news?
Yeah. And also I'll be at the National Restaurant Association show in, I know that I've done the ad read so much, I know the spiel. It's May 18th to the 21st at the McCormick Center in Chicago. I will be there interviewing some amazing folks. And we are honored, as I am, as you know, Canadian. And we are honored to have be able to be a part of this. I'm blown away. And they've been amazing to work with. And you know what? I'm almost speechless. I think I've showed everyone our logo and our brand on their website. So it's really cool to be able to be a part of that and also just get down there and mingle and have some great food and see all the cool stuff.
What's that, Michael?
So you Canadians are fucking unbelievable. I love you guys.
Yeah.
We gotta catch up to you guys. We're only 10% of what you guys do down there. So we got a long road to go. So we're trying our best.
So that's exciting. So you're going to be actually doing live podcasts from NRA show in Chicago. And yeah. So other colleagues of ours would be able to come in, jump into your studio. And
yeah, what I'm hoping to do as well is I'm hoping to actually record the shows, and then we'll do it on my network and do it like a live at the NRA and National Restaurant Association show. And then what also we want to do is I want to go around, and I asked if I was okay if I can do some live shows from the floor and be able to go around and hang out to do some live feed and things like that. So we're going to create a whole bunch of content. I got the Wayne's World moment where the pass where the backstage, you know, they're going around going, look at me. I got one of those. I'm with the band. Yeah, exactly. So that's what we're excited about. And you know what? It's a complete honor to be, I think we got to be the first Canadian to do this. But to be able to be a part of it, I'm speechless. So I'm giddy, having fun. And I love doing these stuff with you guys. And it's an honor just being able to connect with everyone in the US. And thank you. There you go.
Wow. Well, I'm super, you know, we talked on the phone this morning. I'm very grateful for your friendship.
The crack of dawn. The crack
early. I was so excited about the show. I got up at like 4:30 in the morning. You know, I'm very grateful for not only your friendship, but what you do for the industry. And I'm super proud of you and excited that you get to do this. And I know you're going to crush it. Cool. All right, Michael. So Michael and I have been friends for a couple of years. We met at Bar and Restaurant Show a couple of years ago, hit it off.
In Vegas.
In Vegas, yeah. Stayed in contact, and slowly over time started talking about opportunities to work together. And I'm super excited to have him on the show. He's not only super entertaining and fun to talk to, but just a lot of knowledge, brings a lot to the conversation. And excited for you to talk about, you know, what you're doing, share with the audience what you're doing, and then we'll jump into the content.
Okay. Well, first off, one of the first things you want to do, as far as I'm concerned, on a great podcast is completely discredit the host. In this case, it's Monty Silva, my dear friend. And one of the things he said that is technically accurate, but I'm sensitive about, is he said that I was an actor. Now, maybe on Bar Rescue, potentially, when we get into credibility. But for all of you listeners or viewers out there, I was an actor. Monty is not a liar. He's a very credible man. However, I was an actor when I was like 20, and I'm 45 years old. So great experience. Amazing. I got to do a soap opera for about a year. Oh, wow. Built some great friendships. Did a contract on ABC. And then I got myself fired like every other young idiot out there. So it was one of the best lessons of my life. I learned a lot about eating humble pie. I was also that guy that was so in love with the industry of hospitality that at the time I was a barback, just beginning to bartend at the Tribeca Grand. This would have been like 99, 2000. And when I booked the show, like most kids, I just moved there from Florida and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be on TV. This is so cool. And it was, you know, because there was no reality shows back then and soap operas were a big deal. However, I left the Tribeca Grand, at that time, the coolest bar in the world, not in New York, but in the world. And I went to go, you know, to ABC Studios on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So every day I would shoot that. Of course, my lifestyle changed from waking up at, you know, from 2 p.m. as a bartender to having to wake up at 5 a.m. as an actor and go to the set every day. Well, every day when I get done shooting, I would go to the Tribeca Grand and hang out with my real friends who are all Shakespeare, Tisch, Juilliard, Purchase actors, who were all in the bar industry, who were bartending for 12 hours and then writing for 5 hours and going to bed. And those are the guys I wanted to be around in the industry. So I should have known then that I was really in love with that. I was in love with the industry and I wanted to be around those guys all the time. So yes, little backstory on Michael, the actor. Okay, friends.
Cool. All right. So what are you doing these days?
What am I doing these days? Well,
by the way, I hired a million of you guys, people that wanted to be actors, musicians, songwriters, comedians. You are a joy to work with.
You know what, though? Like, I don't want to get into politics because God knows we want to make sure that your show's not polarized. But what I want to tell you is I also want to say that that's probably the Trumpiest thing that Monty Silva could ever say. Right? I've hired a million of you kind of people. Oh man, I love it. Like Monty, so all of you guys out there who don't know Monty, Monty is one of the most humble, powerful guys in the world. It's a tough balance to be powerful and humble. Mm-hmm. And he's that. So it's fun to roast him occasionally.
I love it. That's what this show's about. No, you know, it's funny as I used to say, and you know, I'm obviously not nearly as good looking as you guys, but I used to say when people would say, hey, you know, I'm just kind of doing this acting, you know, this restaurant thing until my acting career takes off.
And, I know. I used to
tell them, I'm just doing this until I get my hand modeling gig off the ground.
So. You know what I always like doing? I learned this from an old friend of mine. It was that I'm doing the acting gig until my hospitality career takes off.
Yeah. Wow. Beautiful.
Yeah. So what am I doing these days? Well, I've been obviously consulting a lot the last now 18 years, which is kind of crazy. I started in 05, 06. I've owned restaurants that have done well and have failed. I've owned bars that have mostly done all well. you know, everyone, I think, in our world has to have this credibility list of like, everything I've done has ever worked and I know everything and I'm a master of the universe. I've managed a lot of places and I've had a great career working with some really amazing people who taught me a lot, took an interest in me, and have consulted a lot independently with a company. So my new company is pretty great, Maverick Theory. There's our big plug that Monty's a part of. So he's part of the plug. Okay. and he's it's just a really, really unique consulting firm that is unlike anything I've ever worked in. So it's pretty neat. And, you know, I'm at a point where we're starting to see it really take shape and really affect people in a way that's pretty amazing in regards to operators and entrepreneurs and having flexibility. So essentially we have 28 now of probably the most high powered consultants in the industry under one roof, between chefs, operations guys, entrepreneurial guys like Monty, who can, you know, do with everything top level and all the way to the bottom. He understands every position, to some of the best beverage, Michelin rated, James Beard nominated. And then also, most importantly, they're all really wonderful people who aren't fucking snobs. So they're all really roll your sleeves up and be badass hospitality restaurant people. So it's pretty cool that people can call us and say, hey, I have a bar in Iowa that needs a beverage menu that's good for that market. And we can send them somebody who can really, really take them to school in a way that's approachable. And then we can also bring a Michelin rated chef into a restaurant in San Francisco and help them. Or we can bring our whole team in. So we do a lot of great coaching. Luckily, Monty, we're very grateful. Monty's one of our coaches and he's a seasoned vet. So that's super helpful for us. And all kidding aside, he's a powerhouse of knowledge as well. But I think the one thing that I love the most about not just our company, but the people we work with and our clients is we're all people's people. We all really enjoy people. And without that, without being able to connect, there's really no point of being in this business. So, you know, it's pretty awesome. And I think if I know correctly, can we get into the content of the show? Because I think that ties into it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. So, I feel very honored. The people that I've met already at Maverick Theory are not only super smart and talented, but like you said, they're people. And that's something that, you know, we're going to talk about in the show of, you know, we're in the hospitality industry, you know, mm-hmm. So people, you have to kind of like people if you're going to be in this industry.
And you have to be able to connect to them as well, which I think is something that people stop. They don't realize that. Like people who have been long in hospitality, they're not able to always look in the mirror and say, am I really good at connecting with people?
Yeah.
Or am I really good at hearing myself talk?
Yeah. Is anybody listening? So let's start with you, Michael. So what is culture? What is culture for you? How do you define that?
Well, I appreciate you asking because this is why I was so stoked to do this episode with you guys, because I feel like culture is like the word brand 10 years ago. It's completely bastardized. Mm. And I feel like culture is almost like an HR go-to word, you know, where people talk about culture because it makes you feel like you're a highly aware individual because you're talking about culture. We're talking about culture in the business and making sure everyone feels valued. You know, like that's great. And it's ultimately HR fluff. But when you look at the nature of what culture really is, it's really how people behave in a tribe. It's tribal behavior. We're tribal by nature as human beings from the beginning of time. So whether it comes together and you want to call it a company or you want to call it a brand or you want to call it an ethos, it's really how a group of people behave within systems and with each other instinctually. And standards. So if you tie it just to hospitality business, which is obviously what we're talking about, culture to me is a general belief system that everybody buys into a bigger idea and that gives everybody a sense of purpose. Like great culture is not the guy who's like, yeah, I'm only a dishwasher in this restaurant. That's crappy culture. Great culture is not that everybody's equal, because I don't think anybody would believe that. I don't mean human equality. I mean, in regards to what we're doing in regards to our role, I think on a Navy aircraft carrier, people understand, the pilot understands the value of his ground crew and his mechanics, but the mechanics feel like the pilot has a way bigger job. And they're always working hard for each other, valuing the other person and what their job is. And that gives more meaning to their job. And that, so when you look at the Blue Angels as like the height of, let's say, Navy aviation excellence and the tip of the spear in America, all the pilots will say, I'm nothing without my ground crew. because they know that if the ground crew falls asleep for a quarter of a second, they could die that air show. So to me, those are examples, but I feel like on a cultural level, it's recognizing hierarchy for the sake of structure and everybody having a deep sense of purpose and buying into something much larger.
Yeah. In the newsletter, this is still a question for you, Michael. In the newsletter that I wrote, I talked about in the beginning of the newsletter about my wife and I walking into a restaurant several years ago, and we just got this like really weird feeling, like it was almost eerie, like there was this darkness, right? We kind of sat there for a minute, we wanted to check out this restaurant, and then we just kind of turned around and walked out. And do you think that, you know, we're talking about tribe being together, common purpose, you feel like that transcends to the level that can be felt, you know, physically felt when you walk into a room?
1,000% it can be felt, because I always say that, you know, our job as wizards behind the curtain, which is really what hospitality operators are, is recognizing that people have 6 senses, not 5, and that everything typically is interpreted through the 6th sense. People's understanding of energy and feeling and tone and inflection of people's voices, how they stand, their body mechanics in a room, like everything. And I always tell people, let's take this to like another level. If you take it to a specific thing of how people can feel it in a room, like you're referencing, look at a bar, let's say an average hotel bar in America. When you walk in and it's quiet at 4 p.m. when you check in, and you see a bartender kind of slouch, very nice person, but slouched at the bar, kind of leaning over, looking at their phone, versus a person who's standing up straight, maybe has their hand on their chin, not their mouth, and is walking around almost like waiting for something to happen. It's such a different feeling when you walk into a space. Somebody being alert and ready, knowing that that's a space where things happen, and their pace on the bar, their body language and their mechanics changes the way you perceive the space. So even on that level, you can make an adjustment. So when I walk into a space and I analyze it, I look at, yes, the physical space itself, the flow patterns, what's happening, yada, yada, yada. But what's the general stance physically and emotionally of the staff? And that'll affect the guests when they walk in.
Yeah, that's great. Jay, what do you think culture is?
I think sometimes I have to think sometimes on this, because I think it's like, well, I think it's important to have a positive culture. I think the energy is important. It's contagious. I think culture to me is like almost this common mantra, in a sense that I think it really helps with the purpose as well as what you're trying to do with your restaurant or your brand that you're working on. But I think it's this underlying thread that is connecting everyone together that you rely on, or you should be relying on, to move together as a group. I always say team, because I played football for a while, but I think the culture, in a sense, has to be nourished. I think you have to feed it all the time. I think it's important to, you can't just say it. And I'm tired of people using buzzwords, in a sense of culture, or, you know, all these other things that we hear, value and all these things that we hear that people throw around very freely without putting some teeth to it. And I'm really big on culture. As long as it's nourished within the organization or restaurant, if people are working on it, it can't just be said, and then that means the culture is positive or it's a great culture to work in. So I really think culture is important as a business. Can I define what culture is? I think it's hard to define what it specifically is, but I do believe that it is something that you need to nourish, create. No one wants to work in a bad culture. Like it's a given. Like no one wants to work in a place that's shitty. We want to work in a place where we feel respected. Like Michael was saying, the tribal aspect of that, I think, is bang on. We want to feel purpose. We want to feel belonged. We want to feel loved. We want to feel that our voices are heard or our ideas. When you don't have that, you can feel that when you walk into a business. You can feel that when you talk to people. Monty, you were on a show recently with me, and you felt what I was feeling just through the virtual aspects thousands of miles away, right? Yeah. So I think that's the culture that you want to have in your business? Is it easy? No. I'm like Michael, I learned more by the restaurants I failed in. Sure. And I learned by the success that I, the ones that were successful, same. 10 to one. But I tend to get, I'm really starting to understand the industry right now is in the need. And this is me hanging out. I think there's a need for positive mindset. And the more that we can shift the mind to a positive, I think we can do stuff right now, because what we're doing right now, I think a lot in the industry is we're trying to pull and trying to have a common ground based on the challenges or the negative that we're seeing right now that we're dealing with. So people are connecting. I haven't been on many shows other than yours, Monty's, where we're looking at cultural or aspects that are positive within the industry. And I think that's important. I like talking about, and I know it's hard today to find some positive stuff, but the amount of people that we get to reach out and hang out with or meet, like I'm like giddy all the time. Not that it's always rainbows and unicorns, by no means, but pulling our minds into going, how can we make this positive or shift towards positive mindsets, I think is important. I really do. Have you guys done the hand thing? Michael, have you done the hand thing?
Okay, you said the hand thing. I was like, the 13-year-old me was terrified.
Did you do the hand thing? Monty, have you done the hand thing?
Wow, what is that?
Okay, see the lines on your hand? Yeah. Put those together in your hand. Okay?
Okay.
Close them together, and then you'll notice one finger is longer than the other. Look at your hands, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have one longer finger?
Yeah.
Michael, you got one longer hand, right?
Correct.
Now take the hand that's shorter. Okay, I'll take this one. It's shorter. And look at it and tell it eight times now. Eight times. That it's going to grow. So say you're going to grow, you're going to grow, you're going to grow.
You're going to grow. You're going to grow.
Eight times.
You're going to grow, 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 you're going to grow.
Now put them together, they'll be the same.
No way.
Freaky. That is positive mind.
Interesting.
Okay, that's good, because when I said the 13-year-old was terrified, it was a masturbation joke. You said, have you done the hand thing? And I'm like, 13-year-old of me is terrified right now. Didn't I meet you in seventh grade? No, that's really cool. That's interesting. I mean, you know, there's other stuff I want to tackle, but I want to wait for Monty to see where he wants to go with this.
In these next two questions, there's probably going to be opportunities to share what you're thinking, because Jay just kind of alluded to, you know, nourishing culture, which is actually our third question. But Michael, when we talked about Maverick Theory, you talked about wanting to create a company where, in essence, your clients were the restaurant people that needed help, but also the consultants and coaches on the team. Like, you were as interested in their experience as you were the client.
Yeah.
So can you talk about, so the second question is, what culture are you wanting? So Maverick Theory, why do you care about, you know, the consultant culture, and what are you trying to do by being as focused on the coaches and consultants as you are on the client?
Sure. This will sound really, I don't know how it's going to sound. It's not my business how it sounds. Cause I want to reimagine the entire industry globally. And to do that, you have to find and identify every problem with it. So in doing that, the interesting thing about our business is that the problems that lie in one particular small 3,000 square foot venue in the middle of wherever are the same things that ail the entire industry. They're almost identical, and they're just scaled much larger. So I started reverse engineering those problems and said, okay, let's just play a game. Think certain problems were fixed. How would that affect the industry as a whole between businesses succeeding and people wanting to be in it and consider it a career? How would I affect this sort of lone wolf middle of nowhere, wild west mentality that is our industry? We probably have the second or third oldest industry in human history, and yet it's the most wild, meaning there's no real certifications. Anyone can do it. There's a huge failure rate. And everybody thinks the way they learned is the way it's done.
Mm.
And we're, even though we're considered, people consider us experts, I never consider myself that. You know, I think that's the difference, is that everyone you meet, you learn how to bartend in Iowa and you worked at eight places on a certain block. You're like, this is how bartending is done. And you're not wrong. Like, you're not wrong. And that's why it's the Wild West. So it just becomes which one's more effective and which one's not. You're also dealing in an industry where there's massive substance problems. It attracts people with organic ADHD to the highest power because of the nature of it. Yeah, and because of the nature and the intensity and the fun of the industry and how much fun it can be. But it's very little like second half of your life type of careers, unless you get into consulting or hotels or things like that. So the short version is, the culture that I want is a self-managing company. And I think that every bar and restaurant wants that culture. And on top of that, I want self-managing company and I want hospitality focused. And to be hospitality focused, you have to think of other people's positions before you think of your own and your ability to do that. So when you look at a captain on a floor or a server, what makes the most at the highest level of our business, regardless of what the food fare is or what you're serving, what separates everybody is their ability to anticipate other people's needs before they do. That's it. Period. So when it comes to our consultants, Monty, you know this, Jay, you know this, consulting in this industry are like independent. Like I always tell people, if you ever watch X-Files and you see Mulder and Scully, I said, if you take them out of the FBI and you make them independent, welcome to being a consultant. You show up to random places, you find out weird, mysterious shit going on in the middle of the night, and you got to solve it and save people or help them make more money. And they're just esoteric and weird.
Right? So, I love that.
You know, yeah. So I'm like, that's the thing is like, how do I hate the way, because union is such a bad word these days when you unionize something. But mm-hmm. how do I make it where a consultant feels like a Nike athlete? Right. Because before Phil Knight did that with Nike, no one, these companies weren't bringing in athletes in the same way. They weren't celebritizing, for lack of a better term, their athletes as their role models. And for us at Maverick Theory, we want to bring in the best of the best in the industry where we're unequivocally credible. So we're able to create a baseline, but then our consultants get to be treated in the same hospitable manner that we expect our clients to learn in. So example, Monty, not to blow you up, because you can trash me in another episode if we don't deliver, but Monty gets booked on a job and part of our thing is costing. How does somebody afford a Monty Silva, you know, or, you know, Brian Duffy? Well, we created scalability is almost like a talent agency. Mm-hmm. Where they're able to go out for a day. Maybe you can't get a celebrity chef for a whole menu for 20 to 40 grand, but maybe you can get them for 2 days to really change your business, you know? And so we started working on that. But the goal for us was how do we build it where a client anywhere in the world can bring in the best people in the industry? And how do you, here's the big one. Here's the big elephant in the room. How does anybody actually quantify you as credible? If you look up all the consulting firms, and if anyone's listening to this, you should do this. Look up top restaurant consulting firms in my area. You'll see they all come up and they all say, like, this person's been in the business for 40 years and they've done all these things. Show me where you worked and exactly what you did.
Yeah.
And if you can't recognize where they worked, it ain't real. I'm not saying they're not credible. I'm just saying, come on. That's why when actors say, hey, I'm a famous actor, and people go, I've never seen anything you've ever done, that's the end of the conversation.
But right? Michael, I got to jump in on that because you're absolutely right. And I see it up here too. Same kind of thing is that people are, I question it all the time because one, I'm like you, I don't run around and say I do this or that and I've done this, but it is to a point where I want to see people that failed. Because I know they're the ones that have actually learned those mistakes that we're trying to help other people with. And I go back because I worked with a franchise for 8 years that it was just crushing it all the time. We couldn't do anything wrong. And then I went and did my own for 3 and we did everything wrong. Right. And I just think you need to look at that when you are looking for coaches or consultants that are out there. Is the ones that tell the truth about their struggle. Because a lot of people don't want to admit those. And that's a red flag to me.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I say, ask the tough questions with your consultants. And ask them, hey, what's your biggest failure?
Yeah. See, that's great. That should be on a shirt too.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, and sometimes it's not about it's also about learning. Like when people ask me, what are some of the biggest things you've learned? It's not all about operations. Like I just had someone today talk to me about it. And they said, how do you know you've had the wrong business partners? They said, by not blaming your old business partners and saying they were the problem, by recognizing that the intentions aren't aligned. What you're trying to do, what they're trying to do, your intentions could be misaligned. And therefore both partners or all groups say, oh, this guy sucks or that girl sucks. But a lot of times it's just misaligned intentions from the very beginning. And then the business pays the price.
Yeah.
Because everybody has to agree and they're just too different.
Yeah.
It doesn't always mean that the business was meant to fail or that it's one person's fault.
Yeah, that's so great. Jay, what do you think? What culture are you wanting in the organizations that you're engaged in?
Honesty. And pure, like, I don't know if there's a new terminology for it, but I want pure honesty. Even if sometimes it is hard to discuss or those conversations are hard sometimes to discuss. I want honesty. And the other thing I want, and I think Michael sent this as well, is that I want to know where we're at. And I do this all the time. And a lot of people don't want to clarify where they stand or where someone says, this is where you're at. And I see that even when I meet with a customer or a restaurant or hotel, whatever, in a lot of times we have to find out actually where they stand, because no one wants to say, shouldn't our industry, like, oh yeah, I suck at this, or I suck at social, or I suck at team building, or whatever the case is, or any challenges, or others, you know, people use the word opportunity, that kind of thing. But when we find out where it is, then we know where we stand and we know where we go. I have too many times in organizations that I am a part of that we don't know where the starting point is. Like, we don't have the realization where we're at. And that drives me crazy. So if I can have a culture, we need pure honesty, but we also need to have the reality of where we're at so we can move forward. Because too many times we're like, oh yeah, we're great and everything else. It's like, no, it's not the reality of what we're really at or what's happening. So I like that when we can have hard conversations. I think having hard conversations is important for a culture. To be able to be open and honest, that comes with trust and also feeling safe, I think is critical, because you can see it in organizations when people have those situations are against them. It is challenging. And then you don't have good work. You don't have, then the quality of work suffers, right?
Yeah, you know, a great saying that I love, and it comes from a guy named Bill W. from AA. I'm not in the program. But the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous was a genius in his own right. And that's ironic. We're talking about it in a hospitality show. But, you know, I have a lot of friends in the program. And my dad was in the program for many years. And it's anonymous, obviously, but there's no problem me mentioning it. But basically, there's a great saying that without the truth, there is no progress.
Yeah.
And I try to live by that within our company and our ethos. And that... you know, that, and also even as you're saying, like tying into that, being honest is, you know, being deemed, for lack of a better term, an expert in something should give you the mindset and credibility to bend the reality other people see as the truth.
Yeah.
And if you really know what you're doing, you should be able to bend the status quo. And you can't do that until you're really truthful about where things are.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, you know, Jay, you're kind of talking about, you know, transparency and self-awareness and just being, you know, I know so many owners that won't show the P&L to the GM, but yet the GM's accountable for it, you know?
Serious?
Yeah, yeah. They don't want them to see the numbers. Like they're hiding something, you know?
Right.
What's that?
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything you want to add to? So you say honesty, transparency, and self-awareness, knowing where you stand. I think there's a lot of managers that take the easy way out. There's one guy or gal that you need to sit down with and talk to about being late, but you don't have the balls to do it. So you tell everybody in a pre-shift meeting. You guys need to be on time, right? That's a lousy way to leave, for sure.
Well, it puts fear. You're almost pulling fear into it, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm going to.
typically the good employees take that personally and they're like, what? I'm not on time. Like they get mad, right?
Yeah.
And the one person it applies to doesn't even has no self-awareness, but doesn't even know you're talking to them.
And see, Monty, I agree with you. I think the one thing that I've tried to do in the culture of the teams that I build is how do you become the best instructor? Right? How do you become, instead of looking at yourself like a consultant, you know, not you, but all of us who tell people mm-hmm. what's going on. Like when you look at instructors in other professions, they get judged on the proficiency of their students, not how much they know. So, you know, as an example, when I'm doing a pre-shift or I'm teaching a manager how to do pre-shifts and three people are late, the minute I ask them, I said, hey, it's no problem. You're late. Don't worry about it. And they all kind of look at me funny. I said, we don't really mind if you're late all the time, but I commit to it. I'm not sarcastic. And everyone just kind of looks around and I say, as long as you guys are comfortable with us, kind of figuring out your money.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, what do you mean? Go, well, if you're not really on time with your part of it, we'll just be a little more loose about your money and how we pay you and your time. And is that cool? And they're like, well, wait a minute. I go, so what do you mean? There's an exchange here? You want us to be very specific, but you're not going to be. You're not going to know your menu. You're not going to be on time, but you are very specific about the money you want and how much time you're putting in. So that's an uneven exchange. And a lot of people understand that in business. They just get a job when they're 15. So all of a sudden that becomes a tool for learning and they go, I never thought about it that way and go, yeah, well, I know I'll learn the menu tomorrow. Okay, cool. Can you give half of your money tonight back to your guests?
Yeah.
They said, well, no. I go, well, what if you went to go buy a $50,000 car and the guy selling it to you couldn't tell you about it, but he wanted you to hurry up and buy it. Well, I never thought about it that way. That's value versus cost.
Or what if it only had 50% of the things that the salesman said it had?
Right.
Yeah.
And you go, well, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry about that, but I still want my 20%. So I'm like, they have to realize that by being tipped employees, they have the same autonomy and freedom as a subcontractor. And they don't know what that is. So it's our job. So this ties into the culture thing. And I do want to add this because you talk about what kind of culture do we want. I think when you talk about culture, you have to talk about the youth. And this is an area where I have to call myself out because like most guys over 40, I think in any industry, or like we talk about Gen Z and we talk about millennials and about technology and, you know, it's just a lot of bullshit where we're like, oh, they're lazy, they don't care, they're not focused. And there's a lot of critique on Gen Z. But the other thing too is when you look at it from the other point of view, I've been challenging my peers and saying, well, maybe we just had better leaders than they do. Mm-hmm. Because we're like, oh, they should be the same way we are. Well, guess what? I didn't grow up with social media when I was 14 and having to worry about all these things, having like three identities to feel insecure about. I only had the one at 13 to feel insecure about. Because you're a kid and you're growing up and you want to be accepted. So these kids are growing up in an era where they can ask Siri for anything. They're also able to come in and go, okay, the girl I finally wanted to ask on a date said no to me to the sixth grade prom. And then I see video of her an hour later with two other people having the time of their life on their ski trip, you know, and I'm like, and I'm 13. How do you process that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Worth, value level, you know, you have your first job. When I had my first job at Subway at 15, I got to quit. I didn't get fired, but it was a great first job. But if I had gotten fired, then I see my manager who's 5 years older, like talking smack about me on social media. Like, what does that do to a kid?
Yeah.
That's why they're so goddamn sensitive.
Well, the other thing too, I think that
I give them a lot more credit now. I think I would have been a train wreck of a human being.
Right? Oh, I would have been.
Yeah. I think that also, you know, when we talk about millennials being lazy or whatever, here's the reality. They're not stupid enough to put up with the crap that we put up with.
That's a great way to put it.
They care more about working to live than living to work. And so they're not cool with a 50, 60, 70 hour work week. That doesn't mean they're lazy. That means because they prioritize other things more important than work. And I think some of that has been good for us to be able to take a look at how we're going to lead this generation in the restaurant world. We can't do it the way we did it because they're just not going to put up with the stupid stuff we did.
But the flip side of that is you're talking about maximum efficiency, which also translates to know your shit.
Yeah.
You come in and work less hours, but you can't do it and not be knowledgeable and not pay attention. So, I mean, there's always a flip side. But anyway, I just had to say that because I feel like I've been really hard on the younger people. And then when I actually started working with them, what I saw was a generation that's dying for leadership. That's dying for someone to pay attention to. Like, I had this one guy in Florida I love, I'll leave nameless, really great guy, his late 20s. He went from being a very subpar average server to being a tremendous server. And he worked hard under a lot of the managers that were under my tutelage, and they're all just wonderful people who I miss a lot. And, you know, he was great. He'd walk up to me. I'd be at my computer doing something at the restaurant, and he'd walk up to me and just go, "Hey, Mr. Tips." So I'm like, "What's going on, dude?" And he goes, "I learned a lot about gin or cognac or something." And I'd say, "Oh yeah?" And we had a really good, like, fun relationship. And he'd be like, "Yeah." He goes, I go, "What about Armagnac?" He's like, "Well, I don't know about that." I'm like, "Fuck off. Come back when you know something." And then he laughed, of course. He laughed because, you know, we had a good rapport. But he laughed and he was, "Okay, I'll come back. Yes, sir." But he was excited. He wanted the camaraderie. He wanted the fun. But he wanted someone not settling for anything. And then he wanted that leadership. So, of course, that's you treat everyone very differently. I'm not advocating on an HR level. That's how you talk to your employees. Okay, everyone out there when it comes to culture. But everyone gets taught differently and everyone learns differently. So,
100%.
I think it's interesting. It's an interesting thing to really evaluate and just look at. And I think that, you know, having those kinds of relationships, when I'm interviewing someone, I try to let them know, I'm like, I'm a super nice guy. I'm not a yeller. I'm not a micromanager. Like, I'm a nice guy. But I'm going to expect that when you show up in my restaurant, that you are the best version of yourself. And if you're not, I'm going to call you out on it and I'm going to push you. And it's amazing, to your point of what you said about the younger generation. They're like, wow, nobody's like held me accountable like that. And so they actually embrace it and love it. And what happens is, if they're not that kind of person, they're going to be like, yeah, no thanks. I don't need the job.
Dude, it's so funny you're saying this, Monty, because I got to tell you something outside of hospitality. So check this shit out. So I'm playing pickup basketball like a month ago at the Y, right? And I'm out there and I haven't played in like a year. And I'm playing, and all the guys, I'm 45, all the guys I'm playing against are like, I don't know, 22 to maybe 28 years old. So I'm a fucking old man out there, right? And I'm playing, and I'm used to my generation from like the 90s to like 2010, where like you're getting verbally beat down on the court. You're just verbally beat down, like the White Man Can't Jump movie, times 10, right? I played in some rough neighborhoods in my life and some average neighborhoods, but just a great time. These fucking kids were unbelievable. I'm playing ball with them, and they're like, I'm like, dude, what are you doing? I go, you're not rebounding. You're only doing what you want to do when you get to score. Play the whole game, not just when you have the ball in your hand. And they're like, yes, sir, hold me accountable. And I'm like, what?
Serious?
Yeah, these kids are like really like normal, cool kids. And one of them's like, absolutely, man, I just want to be held accountable on defense. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I feel like I'm in a Tony Robbins.
No way.
Yeah, and I was like, I couldn't believe this. And all of a sudden, my perspective of the youth shifted, because I'm like, I played basketball for a long time. But it's been, I don't know, 5 years since I played, 7 years. So there's enough for a generational gap. And I'm like, this is unreal. If you told me that really happened on a bet, I'd lose money.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's what these guys are like. And I'm like, how can you not respond to that with an honest heart? And go, okay, dude, here's what we're going to do.
Wow.
It was great. So, I mean, and that's kid who's probably going to be a barback or a bartender somewhere.
Yeah. The final question is, how do you cultivate culture? And I likened in the newsletter culture to agriculture, right? Where the soil is the culture. And if the soil is toxic, then things won't grow.
Yeah, that's good, Monty.
And the employee, the employee is the seed, right? And so if you want an apple tree, you don't plant an orange seed, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want a restaurant that is hospitable, you got to find hospitable people, right? To your point, Michael, you looked for people to fill your company. And so you take this seed of what you want, the fruit that you want to develop, and you plant it in fertile soil that's not toxic, and then you water it. And watering is training, right? You're taking a great culture, dropping the right person in it, and then training them. And then you've got sunlight, right? Which is acclimation. It's like reading a great online review that mentions somebody by name in pre-shift and shining light on the fact that the person crushed it, right? And then unfortunately, the job that we all hate is sometimes we have to go in and pull weeds. And that's what when I think of how do you cultivate culture, I've got to make sure that the culture is healthy and not toxic. I want to look for the right players that are going to give me, they're going to have the mindset and the soft skills to give me what kind of culture I'm trying to build. And then I want to train them, shine light on their successes. You know, we all celebrate success together. And then those seeds don't want toxic people next to them. They don't want to watch their boss allow these things to happen. And when I talk about like this, the right seed in the right place, I'm a 49er fan and I grew up watching them. Joe Montana and Steve Young and everybody else. And
Dwight Clark.
This kid Purdy is a rock star, man. It's just cool to watch him. But they developed a West Coast offense. They found a quarterback that could play West Coast offense, right? They found the player that fits the culture. And I think that it's really important in restaurants to really focus on determining what that culture is and then finding the right people that fit that. So you're not having to babysit someone on their attitude, right? And people that if you're looking at hospitality, these people are not only going to take care of your guests, but they're not going to shirk the responsibilities doing their side work because they're hospitable and they don't want their fellow man to have to carry the weight on them. And so that's kind of what I talked about, in the newsletter, but I'd like to know, Michael, what you do to cultivate culture.
It's a great question. I'll try to limit it because I feel like that it's got a lot of prongs that can go in a lot of different directions. But I think the key is with anything you're doing is to understand that people, what they do affects them. So here's the actual answer. On any level that when I'm working with them or any one of my team is, how do I actually cultivate, right? Is by remembering that you're a human being, not a human doing. And no matter, it's never about what you're doing. It's always about what you're being while you're doing. And if you hold that as a general sentiment, you understand that everything you do affects another person. It also adds a lot of value and it takes away the idea of devaluing something based on the act itself. So it's like, how does the guy who's a janitor who only cleans out toilets become the best janitor ever and have a sense of pride in his work? Maybe he comes from money, but it's the idea of the perfection being in the process, not looking at it going, oh, I clean up shitters or I build the coolest audio systems in the world. It's all subjectively based on what you're being while you're doing that job. It's why people who do rudimentary jobs on an average level never truly grow to be anything special. So, and I don't mean like it's never happened. I don't mean people don't hit the lotto occasionally in life. Obviously it does. But when you look at Quentin Tarantino as a filmmaker and as a writer, and you study him working in video stores his whole life, he didn't just approach that averagely and go, yeah, I work in a video store and one day I'm going to make it as a writer. He used that as a library to study to become student of film and writing structure and storytelling. And he used that time. And that's how he approached working at a video store, right? So the way he approached working at a video store was the same way he did as a writer. So it's no different than when somebody is an usher or they're a porter or they're a barback. I've never seen anybody who's a waiter in my life who was an average waiter who went on to become an amazing actor. Anyone who's been an amazing actor who was a waiter was a really great fucking waiter. Right. And Bruce Willis being an awesome movie star was a fucking badass bartender and people attest to it who are not just Bruce Willis fans. Right. Like, so typically, like, I know that if Denzel Washington didn't make it as an actor and he was a restaurant manager in Chicago, he'd be fucking epic because he's Denzel Washington. It didn't matter that he made it as an actor. Right. Yeah. So that's the bigger thing about culture, about being while you're doing. So to take that down and go, that's a great hurrah speech. Right. But how do I make it specifically to a server who's not doing their side work? By reminding them that what you do fucking matters. And by not doing that, the person that's going to come in after you, you doing this affects the balance of the entire restaurant, because the server who has to come in and make up for the thing that you didn't do fucks up their day, which fucks up the bartender's day, which fucks up the manager's day. So everything you're doing has relevance. So go, if you don't think that it does, go talk to the guy who only handles the pins that come out of the landing gears on an aircraft carrier deck. Just that one job. But if one of them goes missing and gets sucked into an intake, everybody dies.
Yeah.
So every little detail matters. And you have to be able to give them analogies like aviation or art or movies or pop culture to go, oh, wait, I didn't look at it that way. So for me, that's how I cultivate, is by breeding relevance and importance to everything that we're doing. And remember, you're not fucking serving burgers and wine. You're affecting people's day by showing them that they're relevant. It's why they came into your space or section, you know? So, and to sum it up, here's how I really cultivate, and I'll steal it from the great Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, is that, you know, and here's the thing, and I'll kind of end up my note on this, is that I tell people that when Jordan would come in and he was sick, and Phil Jackson talks about this all the time, because there was one point where he was playing and it was irrelevant. They had, you know, they were beating everybody. It was last year with the Bulls. They were like on a 20 game run, and they were playing like the Charlotte Bobcats. And it was like he had cramps where he couldn't get off the bus. And Phil Jackson was just like, dude, you don't need to play today. Just take it easy. We need you for the rest of the season. We'll beat him without you, you know? And he went on, he took painkillers. No one confirms it, but he went and he played. And he was a lot of pain. He scored 40 points that game with back spasm. Oh, no. He's in ice. And Phil Jackson comes up to him and goes, why do you do this to yourself? And he goes, because there's some kid out there who paid for that ticket, who's never seen me, who will never see me again. And this is the one Michael Jordan experience they're ever going to have. And the reason why that's so relevant is everyone goes, yeah, well, that's Michael Jordan. He's the reason why it matters so much, because he didn't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jordan, yeah. It's one fucking kid in a stadium. And it's going to screw up his season potentially. And he's there playing for him because he's Michael Jordan. So even as a server, I would tell people, or as a bartender, if I have one person at my bar today, it's the one Michael Tips experience they're ever going to have. So it gives relevance to at least the fact that I could affect somebody in a positive way. And I'm not comparing myself to Michael Jordan. I'm saying it's a mindset that people have where they discredit their own existence.
So I heard something in the session you did at BRE that I'd never heard before, and I loved it, and I want you to expand on it. It was the domino theory. Remember where you start off with a certain size domino?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to share that? Because I thought
What we do is we compare the size domino to the section of the restaurant or what it is, or whether it's a hotel or a nightclub or, you know, a bar. But essentially that every single domino represents a touch point in anyone's experience in a venue. So you can have the best host, they come in, best service, best all this. But something as simple as the server runs into somebody coming out of the restroom, how is that moment handled? That affects the domino effect has been perfect up until that point. And that domino, how that's handled, can affect the rest of the guest stay. That's the short version of it, right? But essentially one domino falls on the other throughout the space of the venue. So this idea that people give reviews on the food they had or the drinks they had is such a small amount of what their experience, because the dominoes of the entire space and how things are handled experientially affects how they perceive their food and drinks anyway. So, you know, it gives you a different perspective on performance and recognizing that every single touch point is so relevant that you could nail 11 of them, but on the 12th one isn't perfect, you're fucked. And it shades the way the person sees your venue on the way out, or something as simple as everything was awesome, and there's a bunch of garbage on the floor near the exit that the manager didn't see during pre-opening. And is it going to kill them? Are they going to say, I hated the restaurant because there was garbage there? No, but subconsciously it affects them.
And the cool part of that is you can take a domino that's, you know, regular size.
Sure.
And the next one is slightly bigger. And the next one is slightly bigger, and the next one is slightly bigger. And that little domino can actually knock down the last domino that's four times bigger because of the inertia of the impact as it multiplies through the experience. It was just a really cool.
And the best example of that, Monty, is when you have an amazing meal, but the host with goodbyes, hellos and goodbyes just screws it up. Or how you can choose at the front because your reservation's 10 minutes late. It doesn't matter how great the steak is at that point.
Yeah. I used to pull it back into what Disney planned this as well. Disney was an expert in the fact that when you got there to the time you left, right? You left the parking lot, you knew, right? Like you had an experience, but they looked at that. When I work at the restaurants, I always say it's from the parking lot to the plate and back, right? Like it's everything in there. And I remember training our teams we used to have, when it rained or like, when's the last time a hostess or whatever they call it nowadays, your host has an umbrella or opens the door for you while you're walking into the like, these are simple things. They're so simple, but we don't see them anymore. Or, you know, I've been encouraging up here in Canada, like for chefs and restaurateurs to get out of that kitchen and get in and talk with people and mingle with them. We don't see that anymore. That was a 90s practice we used to do. Right. But I tell you, I always say that if you want to learn anything, there's some Disney, they have great training programs. Companies goes down there. They're just amazing. And I love the fact that when they make sure that people leave all the way to their vehicle, get in their vehicle, they still have the same positive notion. Because one of the examples they say is that what happens when you leave Disney and you don't remember where you parked? Now you have a negative mindset, right? Sure. And you're tired. And you're exhausted from the day, you're hot, whatever the case is. And now you're trying to find your car and you don't remember where it's parked. Well, they actually have people that are trained to figure out where your car is. So when they see you struggling, they can go up and say, hey, what time did you come in? And they say, well, this time. Okay, well, then your car is most likely over here. Right? Like those are things that we need to think about in our industry. Well, look,
I mean, Jay, I appreciate you bringing this up because Monty knows I went nuts on this in Vegas. Like, yeah. I tell people, well, especially when people like as operators to hold ourselves accountable. Like when one of my clients is like, dude, I put $1 million in this venue. That's obviously a lot of money. It's no joke, right? But you say, okay, cool. What are the expectations of your guests? Because I think what ends up happening is somebody who's not in the restaurant business wants to open a restaurant. And they're like, look, I did it. I opened. And I always say, well, we're on a public forum to fail. So that's exciting. And now we're at everyone's opinion, even though I'm still being positive, but I say, we spend $1 million. What do you think the expectation of your guest should be at say $40 a head? Right. The problem is I say, what do you think it costs to get into Disney? And they say, oh, I don't know, $120. I said, right. They spent $3.6 billion on their park and they're only spending $120 to get in. You spend $1 million and your two guests are spending $80 to get in. Where's the comparison for experience and expectation with that amount of money invested? You know, they're like, oh, I didn't think about it like that. I'm like, right, because you have to make it consumable for the consumer. So Disney is a good benchmark for all of us to say, okay, well, imagine if I put, I mean, Magic Kingdom itself was built for $400 million in 71, $3.6 billion today. But I went, ironically, went to the Magic Kingdom yesterday with my daughter and my wife.
Did you?
Yeah, just because we were going on this road trip and they wanted to go and we wanted to spend some time together. And it was a great experience. I mean, it was tremendous, you know, and it's obviously built, that park is built more for kids, obviously, but I was on like the whole time. I'm like, there was only one, it was very funny yesterday. I went into this one place, it's like a hot dog stand there and they didn't have the lines really clearly delineated. Now I wasn't in a bad mood and it wasn't busy. So it wasn't a big deal. I wasn't tired, you know, but I went in and they basically had me wait in line and I got there and they're like, oh, you have to wait in this line. I'm like, well, that's good to know because you guys didn't, it's not clearly illustrated. And they're like, oh, okay, sorry. So I went to the next line, just walked all the way over. The girl had heard it. So I went up, I said, no, I'm just going to have a Coke. I didn't want to order anything else because we were leaving. She's like, don't worry, that's on us. Sorry about the confusion. But she didn't, she was far away and she heard it.
And she picked it up. Really?
And at Disney, well, you give me a free Coke, you just save me $400. So, you know, that's a big deal.
Well, that's like, so one final thing, and then I want to hear Jay's thoughts on how he cultivates culture, because we need to wrap up shortly. But I was watching this documentary, and actually it wasn't a documentary. The show that was on is two seasons, and the guy was like taking over his brother's restaurant, and he was a Michelin star chef, and his buddy. What was that? It was named after an animal. What's it called?
Bear. Jay, you know.
Bear. The bear. Yeah.
And Maddie's involved in that.
The server is sitting near, standing near their table, listening. And their job is to know and anticipate. And a table said, we were, the only thing we're disappointed, we really wanted to try Chicago pizza before we left. And the server went and told the maitre d', and the maitre d' ordered a pizza and had it delivered to them as they were paying their bill and said, hey, we heard that you really wanted to do pizza before you left the city, so we're going to send this with you. Like, that's Disney, right? That's the experience that we're shooting for. Anyway, Jay, how do you cultivate culture? And then we'll wrap it up.
I think just creating the environment for it and leading as an example, right? Like, you know, my brand and how I lead and how I work with people is the culture that I want. I want to encourage honesty and to be open and to feel safe. That's how I do it. Honestly, there's no secret sauce. I don't have a special tool, whatever, but I have led some large teams, and honesty is, and admitting when you make a mistake is big time. And leaders don't typically, and as much as you want to listen to the Simon Sinek's and all those boys out there and everyone else, there's still a culture that doesn't admit mistakes that they make. And I lived it, and I'll argue that till anyone I'm in it. And admitting a mistake is very rare, but that was one thing that I really, really encouraged people to call me out or to have the comfort to be able to say, you know what, we don't like this idea, Jay, or no way we're going to do this, or whatever the case is. It was, and I've been both sides. I led kind of the opposite, and then I led where, you know, really creating this environment, this culture where it was very open and honest. And still people today are texting me from back in the day when we ran that huge team. And that was that, and then being accessible all the time. And where, you know, there was I love Simon Sinek, and there's a thing on the, I don't know if it was TikTok or whatever, it was on the other day. And he said, a lot of time people want to talk to you, but they're not direct in the message that they send to you. Mm. Right. So they're sending. So when I was going through a situation recently, and Monty, you reached out even and said, hey dude, I haven't heard from you in a while. I will never forget that, because you understood what I was going through. You knew there was something there, and I was going through it. That meant a lot. But there was other people that don't understand that. But I was reaching out, not in direct messages, but in other way. And Simon Sinek said this about one of the people that is his friends was going through a rough time. And she said to him, I was reaching out. It was like, would you like to come over for a coffee? And he's like, well, it doesn't say that you're having a hard time, or, you know, you're going through everything. So he created the eight minute rule with her, that when she says, do you have 8 minutes to talk? That means it take, cause he believes that 8 minutes, you can really help someone if you listen for 8 minutes. And I do this with a gentleman I work with right now, is that we have a similar rule, is when I call him in the morning or message him later in the day, and it's, hey, you got a minute, is all I need sometimes just to ground myself if I'm going through some challenging times. That's the culture I try to embrace and try to cultivate myself, is to make sure that we're able to do those things and to be open any time of the day. And as you all know, most ideas are not created in the time frame of the day of when you work. It's when you're going to Disney, or you're going to an event, or you're in the water cooler talk outside of the office, or you're going for a coffee, or you're on a podcast, or whatever the case is. It's not actually when you're working on it. It's the stuff that comes out when you're driving, or you're walking, or you're going to the gym, or whatever the case is. That's when these ideas appear. So you may want to call a person or throw an idea at someone. And that's what I love doing.
That's great.
That's very cool.
Cool. Good stuff. Michael, best way to get a hold of you, best way to find out what you're into, what's going on.
Sure. Well, I would encourage everyone, and I would love it, Jay, if you check it out too, is just go to mavericktheory.com. There's some people on there that would love to be on your late night podcast. Really, other than that, just reach out to me at mt@mavericktheory.com, and we'll get back to you.
Is there a reason you got MT for your initials, MT for Maverick Theory? Was that on purpose?
Well, you know, it's funny because it sounds like I'm one egotistical motherfucker, man. Really, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't until after we kind of gave birth to the name that we realized just how maniacal it was on my end and how tyrannical I could come off as. how do you like to consult, Michael? Well, I want to scare and intimidate people and make myself as big as I can. It's just pure irony. That's all it is. So, but it is confusing on internal company emails, though, because I have to put like MT or M theory or math theory and TIT. You know, I have to do all that stuff. But yeah, Maverick Theory is about thinking outside of the box and not settling for the status quo. That's what it's about. So that's the whole goal. But I really appreciate you having me on. This is like one of my favorite podcasts to do, because I feel like it's more people talking about what's really happening versus presentational, you know, BS. And I really enjoy it. I really enjoy you guys. I always enjoy other people you have on here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming on. You'll be on again as a host, and then we, as promised, we'll do that special event with you.
And yeah, we'll talk about Bar Rescue and all of its glory. I made a comment earlier, which I have to. I'm not going to retract it, but I didn't act on Bar Rescue. Okay, but when I was on the show, it was very real the first couple seasons, and then it got very reality. I mean, everyone I'm talking to knows this. They've seen the show a million times. But it's ironically the antithesis of what you can do as a consultant. You can't go on live television, tell someone they're a loser in front of their wife, in front of guests in a restaurant, and then expect them not only to pay you, but for the restaurant to flourish and to make a positive impact in life. So, yeah. But it does help with your ratings on a TV show. So I'll leave it at that.
Cool. Jay, what's the best way to follow you?
The best thing is, well, we do the late night restaurant show, so that we have that. And then Monty, your show. I'm on LinkedIn all the time. That's the best place to grab me.
Right.
Late night restaurant show.
Late
night restaurant show. You know, everyone does that podcast thing where they're like, oh, I'm going to have you as a guest. Call me sometime. No, I'm begging you. I want to be on your show.
There you go.
Well, Michael, we're going to have you on our show. The best part is we get to drink too, because it's late night.
I started that.
Monty started drinking, so he gets half sloshed every time he's on.
I said, this is a late night show. It's on at 9:30. And when I watch Fallon or Leno or any of those other shows, the guest always has a drink.
Yeah. And they brings a drink.
And they record early in the day. It's 9:30 at night. Why would I not have a cocktail in my head? Let's do it.
Well, my co-host showed up with a few drinks in him last night, so he was a little tipsy. So my co-host was having a great time last night on the show we did. And I thought he was going to pass out because he was getting a little bit tired too. So we'd love to have you on.
That'll be good. You guys can use all my last name for all sorts of drunk.
Oh, you know what? We're going to do something. We're going to do something tonight because I got to get back because he's always bloody late to the damn show too. So we always bugged the fact that he was late. So last night he was a little bit late. So anyways, tonight we're going to get him back. I got an idea or two. So.
All right. Cool. All right. What's going on, guys? If you're watching the show, it is going to, it is season 2, episode 1. We are dropping episodes 7 and 8 from season 1 on Apple and Spotify podcasts next week. So please, go back and watch or listen to the episodes that we pre-recorded and that are out on those channels. All right, guys, have a great day. And thank you so much for being on the show. Those of you that are on. All right, great.
See you guys.